Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
The last class of my old professor's life took place once a week in his house, by a window in the study where he could watch a small hibiscus plant shed its pink leaves. The class met on Tuesdays. It began after breakfast. The subject was the meaning of life. It was taught from experience. No books were required, yet many topics were covered, including love, work, community, family, aging, forgiveness, and finally, death. The last lecture was brief, only a few words. A funeral was held in lieu of graduation. The last class of my old professor's life had only one student. I was the student.
So what I mean by accept is see the nature of your reality very clearly and then decide if this is the reality that you want, if you can do something about it. On the existential level, you can't do anything about it. In terms of the fact of death is there, the fact that most human beings get ill during their lifetime, the fact is you're born and need to be nurtured by somebody, you know, and it's on and on, all the things that we can't avoid because we're human, that we have to accept. But unless you're clear on what it is that's happening to you, and how it's happening to you, and how you might get out of it, you're not going to be effective in trying to make the change.
That was the voice of Maury Schwartz. You are listening to Tuesday People, the podcast based on the book Tuesdays with Maury. My name is Mitch Albom, and I had the great honor to sit alongside Maury during his final months of his life every Tuesday and learn some amazing lessons about life, which we are now sharing 25 years later with the original tapes and with a different theme each Tuesday. And we're glad that you're joining us here. What you heard there was Maury Schwartz talking about how he dealt with the fact that he had a diagnosis of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And acceptance was the underpinning and the beginning of his approach to how he was going to deal with it. And that's going to be the theme of today's program, and we're very blessed to be welcoming a special guest in a second to talk about that. Lisa Goich, our producer and co-host, is here as always. Lisa, good to have you here.
Happy Tuesday, Mitch, and Tuesday, people.
The special guest I mentioned is none other than Scott Hamilton, whose name should immediately spark recognition because of his accomplishments in the world of figure skating. He is an Olympic champion, a multi-time U.S. champion. He goes hand in hand with figure skating, from his accomplishments to his TV work to his philanthropy and to just being a really good spokesman and ambassador for the sport and for humanity. But Scott's not here today because he can figure skate, although we would all love to learn how to do that. He's here because, in addition to figure skating, from the time he was a young boy, he has had to deal with illness in the forms of brain tumors, in the form of testicular cancer, in the form of cancer that his own mother ultimately contracted and had to deal with. And he has written several books which touch on all of that in the course of his career. He has a new one that is a children's book called Fritzy Finds a Hat that tells the story of a young boy who tries to find the perfect hat for his mother as she undergoes cancer treatment. And so we thought, what a wonderful opportunity to talk to Scott about this very idea of how do you deal with the world, the people in your world, when illness comes into it. And we want to welcome Scott Hamilton to Tuesday People. Hi, Scott.
Hey, it's great to be on this. I'm excited to talk to you once again. And I mean, this is a subject that truly touches us all. So I'm really honored to be a part of this and to talk to you about the subject.
Well, we're honored as well and glad to have you. So I won't want to assume people will know the background. Begin, if you would, by telling us, even from an early age, how illnesses have kind of dotted your otherwise celebrated life.
Well, I don't, I call it my unique hobby of collecting life-threatening illness. I was adopted at 6 weeks of age, you know, so, my parents, wanted to have a big family. My mother would take a child all the way to birth, and the child, wouldn't make it through the birthing process, just due to different circumstances. So, adopted at 6 weeks of age, I was definitely, small. No one really knew the, nature of that size because being adopted, there's no real history of family or anything else. So, it's sort of a mystery. And, growing up happy and active and like most little boys, it became obvious that around age four that I wasn't growing and that I was showing signs of stress, distended stomach, really no muscle development. I just wasn't growing properly. So for the next 4 years, I was in and out of hospitals trying to come up with some sort of diagnosis to what was wrong with me. And it was obviously, it was very stressful on my family. Back then, children's hospitals weren't as they are today. There was really no place for my mom to sleep except in a chair in the corner of the room. And it was tough to go from one place with no answer to the next place to find no answer to the next place to find no answer.
Yeah.
To the final place was Boston Children's, where they basically said, we can't figure this thing out either. And if we can't, no one can. So just go home and live a normal life and see what happens. And so to give my parents a morning off, I went to the rink and started skating. And for whatever reason, no one could figure out. And to this day, I can't figure it out. I just started to grow and develop and to start being more healthy. And it wasn't, until much later, we feel that we found the source of that illness. It's kind of a mystery all those years. But it's kind of miraculous that skating was really the only thing that helped me in those years.
And what did the source end up being?
A pituitary brain tumor diagnosed in 2004. They gave my wife, information on this type of tumor. And she said, wow, listen to this. And she started to read it. And it said craniopharyngiomas are usually detected early in a child's life due to a lack of growth and development. Hmm. And it was kind of like, aha.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. I was born with this brain tumor. It was doing all of its mischief, and all of a sudden it wasn't. And all I could think of was maybe it was the time that I crashed Gary Walker's bike into the telephone pole at his birthday party. And maybe that hit on the head sort of, made it stop doing its mischief. But, for all those years that I skated, I was able to continue to build muscle and to grow in many ways athletically and, even through the cancer, 97, it was
right. I want to mention that you came down with the testicular cancer. You had a battle with that in 1997, came back from that and skated again. So what I want, and there's more to come, folks, as Scott says, he collected these things. But I want to stop there and ask you, because this is the theme today is to help people who are finding illnesses or bad diagnoses introduced into their lives, how to deal with it. So I want to ask you, because this happened to you when you were young, you were in hospitals for 4 years when you should have been out on the playground. How did that help or hinder or haunt or ease your ability to deal with it, both then and as an adult?
You know, I think when you're a kid, you know, you just really want to play. You want to be a kid. But, you know, for me, for those 4 years, I was surrounded by other sick kids. And so that was my normal. My normal was, you know, I saw this kid, he's being fed through his stomach. I saw this kid who was just coming out of surgery. Another kid, you know, whose parents were around the clock. Another family, they had a daughter. And the dad would bring me a balloon every day, and we would play in the hallway with the balloon. And then one day they stopped coming to the hospital, and I found out that daughter didn't make it. So, you know, for me, that was my normal.
Did that take the fear out of it, Scott, in any way?
I think whatever is normal for whatever, even if it's abnormal, you know, for most people. And for me, it was, you know, I was just around all these kids, and they were at different levels of stress and anxiety. And some were there for short periods of time. Some were there for longer periods of time. But, you know, I could have looked at it as a chamber of horrors, which I did at times. I would hide under my bed so they couldn't find me for the next test. Or I could look at it as, you know, this is kind of my day to day. And my mom was great through all of that. She was an incredible woman. She was very compassionate and very strong and selfless and sacrificial, and she was extraordinary. So, you know, she was kind of my rock during all that time. She was kind of what I hung on to see, am I doing okay? Is this, so, you know, do I trust this person coming in here? You know, how, you know, and I could tell by her mood day to day, you know, what, you know, how I was doing, you know, so I learned that, you know, it wasn't always just how I felt, but how other people felt around me, that I could figure out if I was doing okay. And spoiled rotten, there'd be, you know, on days when there's going to be really invasive tests, you know, there was a toy.
Sure. Yeah.
So I got used to having whatever I wanted.
Maybe the bigger the toy, the worse the test. I don't know. You might have come to dread the big toys.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
When you had to then, in adult life, we mentioned 1997, testicular cancer entered your world. Were you better equipped because of what you had gone through as a child?
You know, maybe. The whole hospital thing was something I was kind of used to. I just felt like this was a fork in the road, and it was up to me to figure out how I wanted to navigate it. You know, I was being moved. I was living this big life and figure skating, and we were selling out arenas all over the country, and I was working hard, and I was being, you know, I was doing well financially. But I just felt like there was something wrong, something about the way that I was living, that it just felt like it wasn't sustainable. It wasn't the way I was supposed to be doing things. I just felt this kind of voice telling me that, you know, you need to course correct. You need, you know, this isn't right. This isn't the way you should be. And so when I was diagnosed with cancer, it was sort of an aha moment. It was like, okay, this is, here we go. I'm being moved. I'm being, you know, set on a new course. And it was in that, you know, the fear of that diagnosis was really crippling. I was you know, 50 cities into a 60 city tour, I was in an emergency room in Peoria, Illinois, where I figured I got to figure out why my abdomen, you know, pain, where it was coming from. I thought I had an ulcer. I couldn't stand up straight. You know, there was all these things. And I was, you know, when you're a figure skater, you can't stand up straight. That's not really a good thing. You know?
Right.
So I went in, I thought I maybe worked myself into an ulcer. And, you know, I stressed about things. I was always kind of worried about everything and everybody else. And I just thought maybe I just worked myself into something bad. And so I went in and they put me through a battery of tests, and then they wanted to do them again. And then the doctor came in and he said, we found a mass. And I thought that was kind of funny because no one ever used the word mass in description of me before. You know, so it was one of those things where I was kind of chuckling. And he goes, no, this is serious. And I go, he said, it's either benign, malignant, or something else. And that's language I heard when my mother was diagnosed with her cancer. And so the fear was just like, I mean, every cell in my body was just, you know, in dread fear. And I saw myself diminishing. I saw myself dying. And then I had this really weird thought, I'll never skate again, which is kind of like weird at the time, you know, because you're thinking about, you know, just surviving. And he said, I don't know the source of it, but if it were me, I'd take care of it right away. And I don't know how it happened, but I took ownership of it almost. I always, when I talk about it, it's either 5 minutes, 5 seconds, or a nanosecond. I have no idea, but that fear kind of turned into a sense of, you know, power. And like, you know, now I'm going to stand up to this thing. I'm going to hit it with everything I can, and I'm going to survive. You know, that survival instinct sort of kind of came out of that initial fear. And I just decided that I'm going to go after this thing with everything I have. And so the journey began. You know, I had to do a show that night. And, you know, I was thinking, of course, that this is the last show I'll ever do in my life, and I better make it a good one, you know. And then the pity party happened in the second half when I was doing, that old, you know, kind of Lieber Stoller song, I Who Have Nothing. It was my big, you know, Bleeding Heart ballad, you know, that year. I'd never really done one. And of all years, you know, to kind of hear that music and those words while I was skating, you know, it took me down to like, you know, okay, here we go. This is the last time I'll ever skate. And I feel so sorry for myself. And looking back on it, you know, I tell that story that I'm feeling sorry for myself. This is the most important performance I've ever given in my whole life. And then I look into the front row and there's a woman, you know, a very attractive woman, and she was fixing her hair and makeup while I was skating. I thought, okay, how big is this? You know, it's like the world goes on. And I just burst out laughing and sort of broke that spell of pity party. And I went into my, you know, triple S is the hardest jump I ever did in competition. And I reached for it and I figured, well, here we go. It's the last one I'll ever do in my life. And it was just like, I was still laughing. And so I landed it on kind of a wobbly leg and got through the rest of the program. And then I got on my tour bus that night and went straight to the Cleveland Clinic. And my treatment back to wellness, you know, sort of began then.
Hmm. You there's so much in what you just said there that is not only fascinating, but is also pertinent to our audience about when, you know, it might not strike that, might not be that cancer, might not be cancer. It certainly isn't going to happen on an ice tour, more than likely. But yet there are a lot of relatable moments to that. So the fear, let's talk about the fear for a moment. I think fear is such a crippling thing, in every walk of life, but particularly when it comes to illness, because, you know, fear of losing your job, fear of losing a girlfriend or a boyfriend, fear of financial things. There are plenty of examples out there of people who do quite well, having endured all of that. But with fear of a disease, and particularly a disease like cancer, the fear is you're not going to come out of it, because there are many examples of people who do not. And you had in your own life, as you say, with your mother. So what's the best way to deal with that fear first and foremost, so that it doesn't cripple you for the battle that you have ahead. So you don't crawl into a hole and just say, I'm just going to be frightened until I die.
You know, I think for everyone, their journey is their journey, you know, and for everyone, you know, we're searching for perspective. And I think everybody kind of looks for, you know, an example or looks for, you know, sort of that life raft of, am I going to be okay? And, you know, where am I going to get the information, the support? For, you know, a lot of them, it's that, you know, appointment with their oncologist is, am I going to be okay? Well, they hear, you know, statistics are blah, blah, blah. And I think that, you know, I've learned so much, you know, throughout my journey that I wanted to fix it in so many ways. You know, when I went on the internet, and the internet back in 1997 isn't what the internet is today, right?
No.
So right. I went on the internet, and all I could find was medical journal papers on testicular cancer, which had 12 syllable words in it. And I was like, wow, I'm too dumb to be sick. You know, I just don't have the intellectual capacity to be sick. So that was like check one. I got to figure this thing out. So I listened to my oncology nurses who, you know, to me are on the front lines, man. They're the people that you interact with day to day. And from there, it just sort of, you know, you go on instincts, right? You sort of, how am I doing? Am I feeling, you know, well, am I going according to the protocol that, you know, they said, you know, after round one of chemo, your hair is going to fall out. Well, mine was falling out anyway, you know, I was balding like day to day, but I was like, you know, how am I doing? How one thing after another, it was almost like, how much can you take now? And so getting through that first round was really remarkable because, you know, I took control and did what, you know, other people told me to do. When your hair falls out, just shave it off. So I did. And, you know, when you get to round two, you know, you've got to start moving and you got to do these. And I just tried to be a good soldier, you know, do as I'm told. And I just sort of look back on that time and I realized that I was flying blind. You know, I needed other, you know, cancer survivors in my life. I needed to know from people that had been there, done that, you know, how am I doing? How am I, you know, 99th percentile or am I, you know, first percentile? I don't know. I'm used to getting marks. I'm used to getting applause. I'm used to getting those things that would kind of give me the feedback on how am I doing? And I didn't have that, you know, really at all. And getting to the end of round three, you know, I realized that I wanted to quit. I had one more round. It was the protocol for testicular cancer back then, and I think it still is, you know, there is pretty much an 8-hour infusion, slow drip infusion over, you know, 8 hours, 5 days in a row. And then, you know, you take 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks off, it's 16 days. And then you come back to the 5 days in a row. And after the third 5 days in a row, I looked at my body. I was bloated. I didn't have a hair on my body. I felt sick. I was tired. That's when the real pity party, you know, sort of kicked in and I just wanted to quit. And my buddy, Steve Cousins, a skater from England, you know, a really dear friend, he looked at me and he smiled and he goes, how many rounds you got left? And I got one more round of 5 days. And he goes, yeah, you can do that. I said, I can do that. So I got through that. And then, I had to take 6 weeks off before the surgery, which is a 38 staple surgery from my sternum down to my groin. It's like, I call it fillet of Scott, right? You know, so they open you up, go through everything and make sure that they're able to see, you know, where the cancer was, what it looks like now, and go through all the lymph just to make sure. And when you're a skater and, you know, core strength is everything to you, and now you've got this scar that goes all the way down, you know, your abdomen, it's kind of like, wow, it's like where it was pliable tissue, you know, of a seam. And it was weird. And the fear was unbelievable going into the surgery, And, you know, the doctor, Dr. Klein, you know, he looked at me right before and he goes, "You ready?" And I go, "I'm scared." And he goes, "What are you scared of?" I go, "Well, have you ever done one of these before?" "I've done 7 this month." And it's like, "Oh, okay, well, I'm good. All right, let's go. We're going to be good to go." And it was there that, you know, after the surgery being, you know, basically you're cancer free, you're done. It's all gone. Your blood counts, you know, everything's normal. We took a, you know, what was twice the size of a grapefruit tumor that shrunk down to the size of a golf ball of dead tissue. We took that out and you're good to go. And for whatever reasons, you know, that year coming back to life, I just got massively ambitious. You know, I put together a program that I thought was 4.5 minutes long and it was really 6:20. And I've never done anything like that bold and adventurous and taxing, you know, so. You know, I just came out of the cancer thing swinging. I just wanted to, I was just fighting to get every bit of my life back. And, you know, I knew that it was, I was given a second chance. And so I was going to, you know, use that second chance and change the way I was living, change, you know, everything. I tell people now when I'm speaking that you've really got 3 choices. You can, you know, succumb, adapt, or evolve. And, instinctually, I just felt like this was the second chance to evolve and to be someone that, you know, different, be someone more alive than I've ever been before. And that was my swing thought going into next life.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, "Hey, we're the Brav Bros, 2 guys that talk about Bravo."
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude. Stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, "Oh, we're 2 dudes that talk about Bravo," people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
I want to play you a cut of Maury when he and I were talking. Of course, he had ALS. It's different than cancer in that they're, you know, sadly at that time and still at this time, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. You know, at best, you might be able to scramble away to stay alive. And at worst, it takes you. And at 78, you know, he wasn't kidding himself. But there are parallels here in terms of, you know, he sort of changed priorities as well, and particularly with his time and the people that he spent his time with, and he found that he could revel in the company of the people that cared about him, and it made a huge difference to him, and he began to feel grateful. And I want to ask you about gratitude after an illness like that. Listen to what Maury said about that.
Find meaning in your present moment. Do the kinds of things that come from the heart. An open, giving, loving heart. When you do that, you're not dissatisfied. You're overwhelmed with gratitude, which is what I find now. You come in, Paul comes in, you know, Debbie's going to come later on in the day. They're just filling me up. So you do that by having those kinds of relationships and making them the important source of your life.
Now, you wouldn't think that gratitude would be a word that necessarily would enter the vocabulary of someone who got hit with a terrible disease or someone who got hit with testicular cancer right in the middle of the prime of their sports and entertainment career. But I'm imagining that gratitude started to play a more significant role in your life, maybe even during the diagnosis and during the treatment and afterwards. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, the treatment, I was fascinated by it. And I guess that's the best way to put it. I at that time, you know, I set some ground rules up that, you know, I really wanted to create sort of a sacred space in my room where I didn't want anybody around me that didn't make me laugh. You know, I really wanted that to be the memory I had during, you know, that time. So, you know, it's like if you admission to my room was make me laugh. And, you know, my friends would show up with, you know, skinhead wigs and Beagle Puss glasses and funny movies. And, you know, it was just they got it. You know, they knew that I didn't want to look back on the time as something of it was awful. Like right after my diagnosis, all the cast, you know, they came up from Dayton on the day off away in the next city. And there was a lot of uncertainty around what was next for me. They knew I was going to have chemo, and they really just wanted to come. All the whole cast wanted to come and just sort of visit with me before, you know, all of that big adventure happened. And Kurt Browning showed up and he goes, you know, we were doing our top 10 list last night in the locker room. And the top 10 list was top 10 things that Scott could do with his discarded testicle. You know? And it was like, that was the best medicine I could have gotten. That was it. It was like, I have to find a way to laugh through all of this and to find humor in all of this. And I had an incredibly supportive skating family. Like I called my Stars and Ice family, you know, I had, you know, dear people to, you know, see me through it, you know, see me through the chemo and, you know, day to day, just sort of look after my needs, which I'll always be grateful for, you know, very special people that I look back on that now and I'm extremely grateful for it. But in my survivorship, like once the whole thing was done, I knew I had to step away from the life that I'd been living. And I don't know why, it was sort of an instinctual thing. It wasn't like I had to, you know, like I was upset or bitter or angry about anything. I wasn't. I just knew that I needed to kind of allow the dust to settle and I needed to step away and almost be alone for a while to kind of figure this thing out. And so I call it my adventure. You know, I was living in Denver, sort of got in my car and I drove and I stopped in Colorado Springs and did a speech, you know, and then from there, it's like, where am I going now? And I just drove until I said, I've never been to New Mexico. So I drove through New Mexico and I thought how beautiful it was. And then I realized that I was really close to a friend of mine ran the La Paloma Resort in Tucson. I said, I could drive there and hang out there for a while and just sort it out. So I called him and I said, can you give me a good deal in a room? And he said, yes. And so driving into Phoenix, an animal jumped out in front of my car. I was in cruise control and I went to dodge the animal and I spun out into the desert and my car was kind of wrapped up in this barbed wire fence. And so, okay, I limped into Tucson, took the car in. It was basically, you know, they said for all intents and purposes, mechanically it's okay, but the car's totaled. And I go, all right, well, time to get a new car. So like,
wow.
You know, it was just sort of reacting. And then I ended up finding the car that I wanted, but it was in L.A. And I said, well, I'll just fly to L.A. and pick it up. And so I did that. And then I stayed with friends in L.A. for a while. And then I decided I needed to kind of spend some time there. I found an apartment. I rented it for the summer. I was working out at a rink in Culver City when I just started, you know, skating again, you know, slowly. And it was, you know, it was crazy. You know, I was diagnosed on March 17th, 1997. And on March 17th, 2000, I was doing a show in Memphis and we would benefit St. Jude Children's Research Hospital at Target House there. Tony Thomas had some guests coming to the show. I thought it was a date, and it really, you know, kind of, it wasn't. It was just friends coming to the show. And so talked to this girl for about 10 minutes, and I realized that now it's time for me to, you know, kind of get off the bench. And I realized I was kind of now, if I could meet somebody like her, I was open to a relationship, you know, really open to kind of stepping back into life. This is 3 years later. You know, I was touring and I was working and kind of just not, it was just sort of like, okay, my adventure time is over, time to step back into life and, you know, and try to find somebody to share my life with. Little did I know it was going to be her. It was crazy. It was we call it best worst day. I'm playing golf with Tony later that summer. He says, you know, he was on the phone, kind of all lovey-dovey. I go, is that girl from Memphis? And he said, Tracy. I go, I don't remember her name, but, you know, I just remember this girl that you had there as your guest. And he goes, no, she's like my little sister. I'm like, really? I kind of thought she was pretty amazing. And he said, well, she's moving to L.A., I think, this week. So I go, can I get her number? So, you know, about a month and a half later, we went out on our first date. We've been together ever since.
All of that happens in this aftermath of, you know, what up till that point is the worst thing that could happen. There's a lot of perspective to be gained on that when you look back on it. And do you now say, because I had that disease, because I had to deal with that disease, I am wiser in what? What would you, how would you finish that sentence? I'm wiser in the area of
perspective. It's, you know, I've learned through my unique hobby of collecting life-threatening illness that our bodies are really fragile. They're susceptible to really, really weird things happening to them. They're also extremely resilient, you know, in certain cases, you know, that you can survive these life-threatening illnesses. And I realized, you know, ultimately that, yeah, they're, we're susceptible and we're resilient, but we're also ultimately temporary. And it gave me this perspective that I've got to, you know, live my days joyfully. And I've got to, you know, no matter what my circumstance, I've just got to take advantage of each day in an extraordinary way, because it's an opportunity for really cool, wonderful, great things to happen. You know, I meet a lot of survivors that they live in dread fear that they're going to have to go through it again. Well, you know, 7 years after my cancer survivorship, I, you know, I'm diagnosed with a brain tumor, you know, and it's kind of like, oh my goodness. So that brain tumor allowed me to understand that I'd always had that brain tumor. I'd always had, you know, this thing kind of that was happening in my body, and now I had to deal with it. So they did radiation, and then I'm thinking, okay, well, I dodged another bullet. And, you know, a year later, we have, you know, actually 4 years later, we have our second child, which is impossible because of, you know, testicular cancer, right? Fertility is kind of like a little bit different. And then a pituitary brain tumor, you know, now what am I going to do? But it just sort of, it all worked out where I had the right medical care, I had the right advice, I had the right perspective. We had the right intentionality. And, you know, when it became apparent that, you know, these six injections a week that I was self-injecting were not going to, you know, give us, you know, what we wanted, Tracy and I talked about it. And I said, you know what, if God wants us to have another child, we will. And sure enough, you know, a couple months later, after giving up on all the injections, we find out that we're expecting Max. So now I'm a father of two. We're blessed beyond our wildest dreams. And the brain tumor comes back. It's like, no, this is not fair. And that one, you know, it's like when I was diagnosed with cancer, it's like, let's get busy, let's get to work. When I was diagnosed with the first brain tumor, you know, it was prayer and more prayer and more prayer. And then when the brain tumor came back in 2010, it was like, okay, this is not fair. And we went into this dread of this whole thing. It was just, you know, it's presented itself for surgery. It's like, oh, I just don't feel good. You know, it's like negative. This one was negative. And it just felt weird that both of us, who had been so positive throughout everything, were now kind of living in this negative space. Well, the surgery didn't go as well as it was supposed to. I developed an aneurysm. I had to kind of figure out how to obliterate that. It was like one surgery became nine. You know, and when it's your brain, it's really frightening. You know, am I going to be diminished? And all these negative things happened, and all these things kept showing up throughout. So even when, even when we think that, you know, things aren't going the way they're supposed to be going, you know, with all the surgery that didn't go and all these frightening things that were happening, you know, it was meant to strengthen us. It was meant to put us in touch with the right things. And it was more prayer and more faith and more, you know, putting our future in his hands. And again, it was perspective. And, you know, hearing Tracy talk about it, you know, years later, when the tumor came back in 2016, she was doing an interview and, you know, and everything it was about, we're going to go through this joyfully. Everything is going to be, no matter what happens next, we're going to approach it joyfully. And, you know, the interviewer was kind of like, well, how do you do that? And she said, you know, I remember it. She said, joy isn't the lack of fear and suffering. It's how you go through it.
Right.
And I was just, I was blown away. It's like, that's why I married you. You get it. You get the whole thing. That's why.
Yeah.
And it's true. It's,
wow. You know, I want to repeat that because it's a really wise analysis. Say it again for us. Joy is not
the lack of fear and suffering. It's how you go through it.
It's how you go through the fear and suffering. And that is such a brilliant arming of people who are listening to us, who are dealing with this or eventually going to have to deal with this in some way, that you don't look at the as, oh, there goes my joy and I can't have any more joy. It's more like, okay, I need my joy. And in listening to your incredible story, and I mean, it is incredible. I note the laughter with which you were able, even when you're talking about things that are scary, you still found moments to be able to laugh. You still surrounded yourself with people who could make you laugh and ultimately married someone who saw the value of joy as not only an ingredient in life, but a weapon in life for when you have to deal with these terrible things. And it is brilliant as a strategy. And there is a reason, Scott, that you have been able to survive all this. And I think at least part of it is to share this kind of stuff with other people. It's a great perspective.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
And you, I don't want to let you go without acknowledging that you, well, first of all, you do an incredible amount of philanthropic work for everything that you've done in the skating world. It's overwhelmed by what you do for other people, and from helping them with their groups to the Scott Hamilton Cares Foundation. But you also went through this on the other side when you lost your mom ultimately to cancer. And you have written a book for kids, which is really important, and we'll end with this lesson, but I think there's something important to share because some of our people who are listening to us, they have children who they themselves are now having to deal with their parents being sick, and how do you deal with that? So you wrote a book, Fritzy Finds a Hat, which sounds very Dr. Seuss-ish, but really it's much more than that. It's a story of a little boy who has to find the hat for his mother because she's undergoing cancer treatment. And as someone who lost his mother to cancer, tell us what you would advise people to tell their children if they themselves or someone that they love is sick or has some kind of terminal illness or has cancer or has something that's scary, as to how the children can best deal with it.
When my mom came home from her doctor's appointment, you know, she just said, family meeting. And we're like, what's a family meeting? We've never really done that before. And she sat us down and she said, now I just come from the doctor. And she had kind of a smile on her face. And she goes, I've just been diagnosed with an illness called cancer. And she was being very matter of fact about it. And she goes, I'm going to have some treatments and I'm going to have some surgery and I'm going to need some help around the house because, you know, I'm still raising a family, teaching school and going to school. I'm just going to need some help and support. And so she gave us all our marching orders. And it was done in a way that it didn't allow us to have the fear that I'm sure she was going through at the time. And the way that she handled her adventure was truly remarkable. You know, she would say things like, oh, this chemotherapy, I finally found a way to lose all this weight. Chemotherapy, I wanted to quit smoking all these years. Now I have no desire. And, oh, this chemotherapy, I've always hated my hair. These wigs are so beautiful and so much easier. And it was like she taught me how to go through cancer in the way that I went through cancer, because I was scared. And then she kind of came back to me, and it was like, no, this is, you know, let's change the environment. Let's make this fun. And I've always thought, when I was diagnosed back with, you know, the tumor again for the third time in 2016, it was like, okay, now I'm going to have to tell the kids, and they're older now and they have perspective. And so it's like, well, how do I tell them? I go, it's a brain tumor back, Dad. I go, it is. It's back. It's fine. And do I look worried? No, I don't look worried. I'm not worried. So let's live our days and let's have our fun and let's, you know, not think about this thing as debilitating. And my mom didn't survive her cancer, but, you know, the way that she went through it really taught me a lot. And I guess in that way, it was sort of the inspiration for, you know, when a parent is diagnosed with cancer, it's what do we do to help them go through it? Well, we do everything that we can. In this way, you know, this little boy was watching his mom go through cancer. It's like, what can I do? Well, I can find her the perfect hat. And it was really fun. You know, Mary Coffin from the Moffitt Cancer Center, you know, since her brainchild. And it's like, well, we need, you know, an illustrator. And I thought, well, you know, my friend Brad Paisley is an artist and he loves to do art. He loves to do other things. But I'll ask him. And so he said, I'd love to do it. And it just seemed like, you know, an amazing thing, because how do we tell our children that, you know, we're up against something, and how do we share this thing in order to humanize it and to make it something that they now can understand in their way? It's not an easy thing. I hate cancer. But you know, I figured instead of waiting for somebody else to do something, we can do something together, you know, through the proceeds of this book, raise money for much needed research in the way of immunotherapy. You know, I do believe that our bodies, you know, create the cancer, have the ability to eradicate it.
Well, you're absolutely right on a million levels, not the least of which is the immunotherapy. As someone who lost a child to cancer, I always thought that that was where the best hope was as well. And we had to travel to Germany and live in Cologne, Germany for stretches of time, because you couldn't get the immunotherapy treatments here in the United States, because it's really just at the beginning stages, and had to go someplace else around the world. And that's crazy. You know, America should be leading the world in saving its children, and it shouldn't be because, FDA holdups or this, that, and the other thing holdups. You shouldn't have to travel
around
the world.
Don't get me started. Again. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's a show for another day, but the, the thing that I want to thank you so much for, Scott, is that you've given some perspective to the fact that you are going to get hit with something in life. None of us get to live forever, and none of us get to live without any blemishes, for 1,000 years. So at some point, something is going to challenge you. It may happen young, as it did to you. It may happen older, as it did to you. It may happen in the middle, as it did to you. You're a walking example of all the different stages. But your resiliency and your proof that, you know, there is a strategy to it, and there are ways to deal with it, and there are ways to come out of it, and not to give away your life to these diseases. Don't give away all your days. Don't give away all your joy. Don't give away all your moments with people. Even Maury, who was lying there unable to move, I mean, you know, literally had to be lifted from place to place, I had to turn his head just to have him look at me. You know, he would say, Mitch, I can't see you, turn my head. So turn his head so that his eyes could make one. Even that, he found the moments of joy, of laughter, of humanity, of communication with the people that he loved in a disease that literally froze him in place. So if he could do that, and you could do what you've done with all the various battles with cancer and brain tumors that have come back, then there is a strategy, folks, and there is something that works, and there is a way. And don't be overcome with the fear, and don't be paralyzed into losing touch with humanity and all the other good things of life that there are because you got an illness. So, Scott, I can't thank you enough. It's been such a pleasure to hear your story. It's just phenomenal. I mean, you know, you've talked for, 30, 40 minutes and never even mentioned winning an Olympic gold medal. And it's such a fascinating story. So we really want to thank you. Thank you for being a part of the Tuesday People podcast and for what you're doing for the world with the Scott Hamilton Cares Foundation. All the proceeds from Fritzy Finds a Hat go to that and to help other people through what you've gone through. So may you have many, many, many more years, and may you join us again on this podcast sometime in the future.
Oh, you're so kind. And you know, I appreciate all that you do in the community and all the awareness and everything you do in Haiti. And I have two Haitian children. So, you know, it's anyone that loves Haiti as much as we do, you know, I'm grateful. And, you know, this life is meant to be lived, and I appreciate, you know, this platform that you are allowing people to truly understand their lives differently and in a much more impactful and healthy way. So thank you for everything that you're doing. And I love your writing. I love your platform. I love what you do for Detroit. I mean, you're a good, good man, and I'm inspired by you.
Well, the feeling is doubly mutual, and I really appreciate you taking time, and thanks. We'll talk again, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Scott Hamilton joining us here on the Tuesday People podcast. We will be back next Tuesday with another lesson shared from my old professor, and hopefully that helps make your life better. Until then, with Lisa Goich, this is Mitch Albom wishing you a great week and see you next Tuesday.
Thank you for listening to Tuesday People. To be part of our conversation, join the Tuesday People community at WeTuesdayPeople.com. Subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss an episode and share it with your friends. We look forward to having you with us every Tuesday because, after all, we're Tuesday people.